The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 52 for May 8th, 2006. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave. I'm here with John. Hi, John.
Hi. Hi, Dave.
And we've got a ton to go through this evening. We have, well, of course, it's evening, morning, whatever it is for you. It's evening for us at the moment. Hopefully, it will still be evening when the show's over, because we've got a ton to go through. All kinds of stuff.
I'll keep an eye on the
clock. What's that? You'll keep, yeah.
I'll keep an eye on the clock.
Please do. That's right. And thank you to our excellent listeners here for inviting us yet again into your home, office, car, restroom, wherever it is you choose to listen to the show. So let's jump right into things here, John, with we're basically answering reader feedback, listener feedback all night. We've got a couple of continuing conversations, specifically the converting files thing. We've had a couple of good suggestions on that in a boot camp thing, maybe, that we'll get to. But for now, we will start with something new, and it will be from Joe.
Hey, John and Dave. Joe here in Raleigh again. Had a comment for the listeners that I actually finally remembered here. And it's with regards to some of the new security features that were suggested as part of some of the exploits that folks have seen in Safari and such, with some of these, quote, new viruses that have become available on the Mac. But one of those suggestions was to go through and have a admin account that you literally just use for admin and change all your normal working accounts into non-admin accounts as an extra security step. So dutifully, I got around to doing that. And when the recent 10.4.6 update came out and verified that it was solid, I attempted to go through my normal routine of using Carbon Copy Cloner to clone my hard drive to the second drive in my G5 Mac. And once there, I usually reboot off of that and then apply the update to that. So if anything goes funky, then I can always go back to the one I had been working on for the last few months. Well, in the process of trying to...
That's actually really smart thinking, you know. Did you hear that? Did you catch that, John?
Yes, using another drive to...
Test the update.
Back out of.
Yeah, that's interesting. Of course, it leaves you with no. If you decide the update works, and then you do it on your main drive, it leaves you with no backup of the way it was before. But that's not a bad little kind of litmus test. So, all right, we'll go on with the question here.
Trying to do this, I found that I could not get a solid copy from Carbon Copy Cloner as a clone. This had worked flawlessly in numerous different versions of the update before, but this time would not work. I went out to the web and pulled another cloning utility, tried the same thing, and it came back with an error indicating could not read source. And this was really kind of strange. So anyhow, what ended up being the issue was that if you are not logged in as the admin user when you try to do one of these clones, it cannot make a complete copy of everything, even though the routines tend to ask you, or at least Carbon Copy Cloner did, it asked you for the admin username and account so that it could do its thing and make the clone. But it still was not able, apparently, to access all information, and hence would fail every single time on that. Now, this may be totally obvious to you guys, and perhaps even some of the users, but I probably spent a couple of 3 hours over... a couple of days before I finally figured this out. I thought it might be helpful to some of the listeners out there. Anyway, enjoy the show. Keep up the good work. Probably the best podcast out there on Mac there is, I think, probably.
Well, thank you, Joe. That's actually very kind of you to say that. That's not why we played your comment, though. That is a good point. You know, with all this renewed focus on security, or new focus on security with the Mac, there's a lot of folks that are doing exactly what Joe's doing. And it makes sense. I'm assuming how are you running your machine, John? Are you doing the non-admin user for everyday tasks thing, or are you just throwing caution to the wind?
Absolutely not.
Oh, good. Okay. Excellent.
I'm admin. I've never changed from that, but I know it's probably a good thing to do, but
right.
Well, especially I mean, you have a need because you have multiple people.
What do you mean? I have multi in my head or at my house?
Oh, yes. Well, I don't know about your head. I mean, okay. I've long suspected. But... All right, stop the funny stuff.
Yeah.
Someone said. So yeah, you probably have more insight than I do, since I do not set up separate users. I'm just in there as myself, and I'm in as an admin.
Yeah. On my machine, I always set up an extra user for another admin user, actually, for diagnostic purposes in case something happens to my main account. But I leave my main account as an admin account. There was actually an email discussion sort of going on amongst a couple of us. A listener sort of tied Adam Christensen from the MacCast and John and I together on this discussion. And the point was, you know, if you're trying to drag something, the system makes it seem like the admin privileges do more than they actually do. In 10.4, if you are in the Finder and try to drag something out of your applications folder, many times it will tell you that you have to authenticate to do that. That's sort of misleading, because it leads you to believe that the things in your applications folder are actually owned and protected by root. That's not the case. And this listener was very smart to point out, if you go to the terminal and delete the files there, they'll just simply go away without having to, you know, authenticate or use sudo or whatever. And of course, the listener then jumped to the conclusion that, well, because of that, what's the point of having an admin account? Well, there are many files, and they are specifically the files, many of them rather, that would make your Mac bootable, that live in directories you don't see, /etc/private, places like that, that are only modifiable by root. And though some of them are readable by the entire system, some of them are not. You need to have root privileges in order to read them. And those do require you to type in your password. You cannot... unless you've activated the root user and are logging in as that, and that's a series of steps that you would have to go out of your way to take, the admin account is still fairly protected. So, I think you're okay. But as Joe pointed out for us, if you go ahead and do take that advice, and it's, you know, it probably won't drive you crazy unless you're doing a lot of installs all the time. Just remember that when you do your backups, that's what you're stuck with, because you've got to go and do the whole carbon copy cloner thing from the admin account. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Right, John?
That's what I do anyways. And one thing to note, I don't think it was an issue with in this case, but there is this ignore ownership on this volume checkbox for non-boot volumes.
Right.
Which, if you are concerned about permissions, well, depending on what you want to do, I've always kind of wrestled with why they have that.
Well, I can tell you, actually.
Or that it causes confusion.
It can. Well, yeah, by default, I think it's checked, right? So that any FireWire drive that you mount, permissions are simply ignored. You know, you can read and write everything on the drive. The OS will let you do it. The problem is, if you're using something like Carbon Copy Cloner to make a copy of your boot volume to a FireWire disk, you need to uncheck that box. Otherwise, it won't be able to make a proper permissioned clone of your boot drive, and things won't work right. So,
yeah, and I think the current version does notice that.
Does it really? Good. It should. It should.
Or a version of it says, hey, you really want to
yeah.
do this properly, right?
That's right. Yeah. All right. Well, we have another permission thing from James, and we will jump right to that now.
Hey, Dave and John. This is James Marino. I emailed last week, and I promised that I would send in an audio comment, so here it is. Actually, this is more of an audio question. Is there a tool out there that will help reassign permissions? I'm an admin at work and very often run into permission errors when migrating users from one machine to another. I do check the ignore permissions on this volume when mounting an external disk, and I have tried setting permissions from within the Get Info window, but that never seems to work for me. Any help would be appreciated. Also, for the future, can I send in XServe questions, or is that too geeky? Thanks so much.
Well, it depends on how geeky it gets with the XServe, but John... neither John
big
nor
rack
I,
mount Mac.
Yeah, neither John nor I manages an Xserve machine, so we may or may not be able to answer them. But you're free to send in anything you like. As far as
I
this
have
question,
used one once.
Oh well, there you
excellent
go.
Excellent form factor.
Oh yeah, yeah. With regards to this question, I actually emailed James to try and get a better understanding of what it was that he was trying to do. And what he told me was that he's running an admin, an admin account in 10.4.6, and he's got, an entire user folder, many, many files and folders within that one folder, copied from, the Xserve or some other machine to his local drive. And he's having read and write ownership problems. And he's trying to find a way to batch change permissions by choosing the folder, get info, set permissions, and then apply to enclosed items. But it doesn't work. It says that he doesn't have permission to complete the operation, but he's running his admin. Mm-hmm. Aha. So what's happening is when you're running his admin, as we discussed, you only have the ability to become root to do things system-wide that would affect other users or the system in general. You aren't always set at that status. So presumably these files come in with ownership values that are different from whatever his admin account is. Therefore, he can't make any changes to it. If you've got multiple users on your machine, even if you're an admin, you can't go, muck around in their user directories unless you become root. So the trick to do this, there's probably a way to do it from the GUI, but it's simple enough to open up the terminal. The first thing you want to do actually is open up the system preferences login and figure out what your short username is if you don't know it already, because you're going to need it for this this little trip to the terminal. And then you head to the terminal and type sudo, S-U-D-O, and then you use a command called chown or change owner, C-H-O-W-N. And what that lets you do is change the owner of a given file, and it lets you change the group too, and that's sort of relevant, but not really. And it allow you to do it recursively to many, many folders in a hierarchy all at once. And so you do sudo chown space dash capital R for recursive. Then you type your short username, a colon, and your short username again to assign the group properly, another space, and the path to the folder. And that's it. It might take a couple of minutes as it, traipses through the hierarchy that you've laid out there, but it will go and change all the permissions. Of course, it'll ask you for your password first because you're using the sudo command, which of course you give it and then off it goes. Does that make sense, John? Did I get that right?
I think you did.
Okay.
Yes. I'm curious here. The one way to get root, I don't know if you've dabbled with this, but there, which is, really instinctual, is you go to Net Info Manager.
Yeah.
Have you ever done this?
Yes.
And there's a security tab, and you authenticate, and then it says enable root user.
That's right.
Now, if you enable that root user, would that command then work properly?
Well, you'd have to log out and log back in as the root user. When you do that, it just adds another, doesn't add another user to your system. It sort of allows you to use this root user that's sort of there but not there. So yeah, you could do that, but you'd wind up, and then at that point you could do it from the GUI because you're the root user and you can do whatever you want. Frankly, using the root user from the GUI, it's really not meant to. Remember, the Finder and pretty much anything that you see in the GUI is just an overlay on top of Unix. Apple's obviously done a very nice job with it, but it's built to be used a certain way. You start mucking around in there as the root user, things start getting a little confused. The Finder's it's just not expecting to be able to do all these things, or it's not expecting to be able to make the sweeping changes that root would let you make. I mean, you could very easily at that point start deleting files that your system needs and never be able to boot again. So
that's bad.
Yeah, yeah. I don't do it. So, I leave it disabled. The sudo command is enough for me. I'm fairly comfortable at the terminal, so that's, that's the caveat there is by not having the root user enabled, I need to do it. Now, there was a utility years ago by a fellow named Brian Hill called sudo, P-S-E-U-D-O, that would allow you to run certain applications in the GUI as root, and you could even relaunch the Finder. as root. I haven't used that utility in a while, but that would be another way to do it. Again, the same caveat applies. Be very careful with what you're doing. So, you know, there you go. You want to answer this multiple apps question from Iggy here, John?
I can give that a whirl. Let's...
Iggy says, I thought it was time to send in a question. No audio comment. I'm afraid my mic and mixer are at home. So the question, when I right-click slash control-click on a file and select open with, say, a movie file, picture file, or music file, the list contains all the apps that can open it as it should. But for some reason, some apps are listed in triplicate. For example, if I right-click on an MP3 file, I get iTunes listed as the default, then Cast Easy is listed 3 times, iTunes listed another 2, QuickTimes 3 times, Real Player thrice, etc., etc., etc.
Yeah.
What's the answer, John?
What a mess. How should I know?
Because you said
I said I knew
this.
The answer to
you
this
did.
One.
Yeah, you...
Well, one thing I would try is something called RC Default App. Have you heard of this?
I have not. Nope.
It's a pref pane, you know, which is something that you can add to the system preferences. What's really nice with the latest ones is that if you double-click on them, it rather than having to drag it over to a folder, it says, hey, you want me to install this? Oh. But basically, it shows you a nice graphical table view of a lot of these mappings that are otherwise hidden in some obscure plist file
okay.
you know, in the depths somewhere.
Okay.
And this one has, and from what I could gather of reading up very quickly on this, I did use it in the past. I mean, this will handle a lot of things, but it has a section for applications. And from what I can see, this is what lets you change the application mapping.
Okay.
So if you click on an app in here, like for example, you know, I'll click on Acrobat Reader, and it says, hey, I can handle all of these types of files.
Right.
So.
Yeah, but why is it listing, will this then clean up that list? You know, because I see this too, where I'll right-click on something and see the same app listed multiple times. Now, I have seen it where it's the same app but different versions of it simply because they're littered on various hard drives I've got connected or whatever. But I've also seen it where it's, you know, it looks like just the same app over and over again.
Yeah, from what I can gather, this will allow you to edit those or uncheck those mappings. Mm. So I think if it's a mess, it'll come up in this as showing the item multiple times. I didn't have that specific problem come up.
Got it.
But this is something that lets you change a whole bunch of, you know, like internet mappings, you know, what's your default web browser, email browser, stuff like that. Some of this is in other places, but it's kind of nice that this has it all in one place.
Very
cool.
You
know, what app to launch when you insert certain types of media, what to do with certain URL types.
Okay.
Et cetera. Huh. So
very
that's something we'll, of course, link to, but it's a very nice utility. It lets you get at the guts with, but still maintain some GUI.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Huh. I'm looking at the screenshots here, and it actually looks like it might be relatively, relatively intuitive, and that's a good thing. So.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want your question answered, you can email it to macgeekgab@macobserver.com, Skype it into macgeekgab, or phone it in to 206-666-GEEK.
Geek.
Yep, and I believe, let's see, where are we going here?
Now what? Hit me.
Joe, and it may be the same Joe, has a tech support question, so let's listen.
Hey, John and Dave, this is Joe from North Carolina.
Different Joe.
I had a question about Apple's tech support. You may, or some of your listeners might have run into this problem. I called Apple to ask them about a very technical question regarding Final Cut Pro, something that only like a real power user or somebody who had helped design the program would be able to answer, and I hadn't had any luck on the support boards. And the technical support representative informed me that my question was beyond the scope of Apple's guaranteed technical support for my product. He even referred me to the boards, even though I told him repeatedly that my question couldn't be answered by the people on the boards after repeated tries. But I know that someone at Apple would know the answer because it had to do with the technical design of the program. But he gave me the runaround, and I never was able to get someone on the phone who can answer the question. So I wanted to know if anyone else had that experience, getting denied by Apple tech support. All right, well, great show, and I look forward to the next one. I listened to the last third of your previous podcast in my birthday suit. I slipped my boxers off and walked around the house naked as the day I was born. Great show. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Yeah,
we're supposed
to
pause that.
We'll just sort of let that linger.
No, please.
Well, I have sort of a general response here. Do you have something specific about his?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well then go.
There happens to be a product from Apple because I have perused every now and then the request of coworkers who were wondering about support. Gee, you know how can I get certain types of support? And they have something called AppleCare Professional Video Support.
Really?
It's a special package, yes, and we will link to it, of course, but I'm looking at it right now. Direct access to Apple's professional video technical support team. And it mentions that this is probably a good option if you have programs such as Final Cut Pro.
Interesting. And I'm assuming there's a cost involved.
Oh, absolutely. Of course.
Yeah, that's okay, though. How much is it?
Well, all I see here is $7.99. I'm going to assume that's for a year.
Okay.
But it would sound to me that's probably kind of pricey for an individual who has an advanced question.
Yeah.
But if you're a video house, then something like this is, you know, just the cost of
doing
what
you
got to do.
Yeah.
So, I did find that. I hadn't seen that in the past. I know they have, they're always coming up with, you know, new creative AppleCare programs. And
yeah.
This is one of them, I guess.
Yeah. My feeling and I had no idea about this. That's actually fantastic. So hopefully Joe.
There's an audio one too.
Okay. So hopefully Joe's listening and can take advantage of that if it makes sense for him to do so. But, my initial feeling on this was, you know, a company can only go so far with free tech support. You know, there are things, even Microsoft, you know, with Windows, you'll wind up paying for support, and even Apple when you're out of warranty, you know, if you're past 90 days owning the machine, you're into, you know, for pay per incident phone support, unless you buy AppleCare on the machine, or in this case, buy AppleCare for the product in question. It wouldn't make sense for them to bundle in the cost of full support with their products. They used to, but it doesn't make sense for all of us to have to pay for the same level of support, right? I mean, I'll just use myself as an example. I don't need a huge level of support with Mac OS X Tiger. I can get what I need. I know how to go online and find it. I know how to, you know, or figure it out myself. Now, there are some people that you know, that's just not an option, or they prefer not to do that. And so you can pay more, but why make the guy that knows more, especially with Final Cut Pro? I mean, you've got some gurus out there. Why make them pay double for the product, right? Just so that someone that's new to the product can get free support. And of course, then your options are open. You're not locked in. It's not like you paid double for the product and Apple's your only hope. You've got free reign. You can go to any one of 1,000, you know, you can go to any one of 1,000 Final Cut experts, which would probably be better in Joe's case than FileMaker. But, you know, who can help you with this? And maybe even somebody that can come to your shop and work with you for an hour. And that may actually be a very good option. So, you know, there's that whole Apple Consultants network out there. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with using that. There's a lot of benefit to that. So,
yeah, I don't know. I really expect you to pay for my support costs.
Mm-hmm. I know
should
you do,
subsidize.
John. You want me to subsidize it? It's like taxes, right?
But yeah, no, I do remember. I mean, gosh, I remember when they included schematics.
Yeah.
With the machine, like some of the early Apple machines.
Yeah.
They give you. You know, so you knew exactly what was going on inside. Now that's probably
and
not
now,
very
and now,
feasible.
Of course, they sue websites who publish links to the service manuals, right? Did you hear about that last week? Somethingawful.com. Somebody in the forums over at Something Awful.
Funny site.
Funny site, but not for the kids. So, you know, consider yourself warned. Or not for the faint at heart either. But, you know, somebody in the forums just posted a link to the MacBook Pro service manual. And Apple Legal got all over Something Awful. And, you know, the guy said, well, wait a minute. I didn't, you know, I'm not hosting this file.
Oh, did he have his lawyer?
I don't think
he
had. The
guy
who
he pretends is his lawyer.
That's right.
And write very silly letters.
I don't think
it's so funny.
Yes, oh,
Krabs,
I know.
I think was his name.
Yeah.
He says, oh, you know, I got my lawyer.
Yeah.
You can't sue somebody for linking to something you don't like.
I don't think so. I mean,
you go to the people, at least in this country, right?
Yeah. I don't know. And I don't think it was linked to a server in this country. I think that was part of the issue. So, but anyway, that's our feelings on support. And here's something that sort of leads into this from Doug.
Hey, Doug from Connecticut. How you doing? Long time listener, couple time caller. I have a question for you. I know one of you has a MacBook Pro.
Yep.
And I recently myself, but I bought a refurbished unit, and it's 100%. Except I have the little wine problem, which I know a lot of people on the Apple side have talked about and repeated. And I also had it seems a little warm sometimes, but that's really not me. My wife was using it the other day, and she said, wow, it's getting pretty hot. Talking about the laptop, of course. Just curious if you saw those posts where people have actually opened the MacBook Pro and noticed that the thermal grease was kind of globbed onto all the processor chips, and they reapplied it with a nice coat of like some kind of special silicon some good silicon gel, sorry, and they said the heat dropped, the temperature dropped a lot. I'm just curious if you guys are even considering something like that. I know it's a little dangerous, so void your warranty, and I'm probably not gonna do it myself. And the wine issue seemed to go away for me, but I'm just curious if you guys have any thoughts on that, and something you've experienced on your machine, and anything you've done to fix that. Anyway, great show. Keep up the good work, and I look forward to listening to your next podcast. See you guys later. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Doug. I'm the one with the MacBook Pro, and no, I haven't had the wine issue. As far as the heat issue, I'm not sure if mine is within tolerance or not. It seems hot, but again, it's livable. And no, I wouldn't take my computer apart. And this is something that's fascinated me reading all this. First of all, despite the fact that I've worked on computers for years, I am a chicken when it comes to laptops. So I'll just state that right out of the gate. But even still, even if I wasn't, every single one of these MacBook Pros that's out there is under warranty. And this is more directed at the folks that post to these forums or that have been posting to the forums, not you in particular, Doug. What makes you think that it's a good idea for your first path of a solution to go and rip your computer open to, you know, change out the processor spooge? Why would you want to do that? Why wouldn't you call Apple first? Everyone that I've talked to that's had this problem and called Apple has gotten a satisfactory resolution out of it. Apple's swapping these machines out like hotcakes, which is kind of a funny analogy. But anyway, I don't get it. You know, everybody complains about this, even on the Apple support boards, and none of the complainers, it seems, go and just call Apple. You know, Joe had a problem with Final Cut Pro. He tried the support boards, couldn't get an answer there, and then he called Apple. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, don't rip your computer open. I'll guarantee you that if you're listening to this in the year 2006, your MacBook Pro's under warranty. No question about it. They did not start shipping them in 2005, you know. So, and then you got a year warranty minimum on the thing. And if you bought AppleCare, you get more. So just go and just call them up, right? I mean,
if there's a problem, I mean, they've gotten raided, though some people will say they're biased, but, you know, Consumer Reports and all that. I mean, if you got a case, I've had to deal with AppleCare, you know, they
work fine.
Support people. I'm sure you have on many occasions. And
yeah.
They'll try to do the right thing as long as you're not like, you know, oh, it got a little smudge on the, you know, something, which I've seen that too. You know, speaking about the wine, from things about the Mac whining.
Yeah. Yeah. There's more. It's more than the MacBook whining here.
Some users expect perfection.
Yeah, well, these things are mass produced. You got to, and it's revision, 1.0. I know they've been through four motherboard revisions, but still, it's, 1.0 of this product. There's going to be issues. You got to know that going in. You just got to, expect it. It's fine. One thing I will state, I've sent quite a few things into AppleCare. I know you have too, John. Mm-hmm. And in general, when you're calling tech support, my feeling is, the guy on the guy or girl, woman, whatever,
gal,
the person on the other end of the phone, is the only person in the world that can help you at that point. So I find being extra courteous and very polite to them and ever so thankful for them helping you
No, you got to scream at them.
Right, that's right, yeah.
You got to put the weight of the world on their shoulders.
Right.
If you abuse them, then they'll want to help you.
Then they'll want to help you. Exactly. That's the logic. No, seriously.
Think about it.
Yeah, I'm always very nice to them. You know, thank them. I always explain to them, look, I know this isn't your problem. It's my problem. I appreciate you taking the time. And that gets them really helpful. And then if you do get to a point where it hits a wall where they can't help you, you can say, listen, just for my own satisfaction, would you mind passing me along to a second level support so that I can, you know, at least be, you know, have a second opinion here and get through it. And if at that point they say, no, I think I've given you the right answer, then you can get snotty with them because, of course, you've given up on them and it's time to move on.
Then you say, do you know who I am?
Oh, my God. No, I don't do that.
Or,
usually.
I know Steve.
Oh, no.
We can erase that.
Yeah,
don't say you know Steve unless you actually know Steve.
Unless you happen to know
him. In which case.
Yeah, then just call Steve. Yeah, he'll get you. I'm sure there's a whole different support department for...
Here's the secret code you got to...
Friends of Steve. Of course.
Can we tell them the secret code to access, you know, the special support line?
If you know it, man, tell me. I don't have it.
I can't tell you.
Oh, okay, all right.
But yeah, they've been great when I've dealt with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even one time I was like, you know, it was that long drawn out repair thing. I'm like, you know, you're losing money every time you speak to me. And he's like, yeah, I know. That's why we're trying to wrap this up.
Right. We're going to fix this up fast. So, all right. Last week we ran a comment about a teacher that was having trouble opening WordPerfect files sent to him from his students. And Alan actually wrote in with...
I'd fail him.
Wow. Alan wrote in with the answer, with a potential answer, and he says, I was just listening to the show, thought I'd pass along a tip. I don't know about works files, but Abbey Word, which is freeware from abbeyword.com, has done wonders for me for WordPerfect files. He does programming for a number of government agencies, and the FBI still, they're going to come get us, still uses WordPerfect as their document standard. Yeah, a lot of government agencies use WordPerfect as their document standard still.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
That's it. Government efficiency at its finest, according to Alan. So try abbeyword.com to open up those files, and perhaps that'll take care of it. Mm. And then moving on to boot camp, we actually had two emails here, and I'm going to try and get them going in the right order. Of course, I can't find the first one here. I don't know why I can't find this. All right, well, we're just going to run the second one then. About running Windows XP on an external drive, Aaron wrote in and says he was surprised to hear that us say that this was impossible. I've been running this very setup for the last 2 weeks. Initially, I ran into the problem that your listener described. After the first phase of Windows setup, the machine would reboot and Windows would then halt with an inaccessible boot device error code. I don't give up easily. Undeterred, I went looking for a solution to this, as I didn't want to divide up my new MacBook Pro's hard drive, which is actually not a bad thing. I'd much rather just run Windows on those rare occasions when I actually want to run Windows from an external drive and keep all of the space on the internal drive for OS X. It took a day or two for me to track it down, but there is a solution. This is not an out-of-the-box solution. There's no setup option in XP that will allow you to do this or anything. It involves a bit of INF file editing and reburning a new copy of Windows with the modified files. I'm no hacker, but from what I understand, this technique basically forces Windows to stop treating the USB system as an input device and start treating it as a mass storage device, preventing Windows from restarting it during boot up. He did give us a link to the tutorial, and of course we'll put that in the show notes. And he says he's been running it for about 2 weeks, and it works just fine. He says it is a bit slower than running Windows XP on an internal drive, but for whatever reason, that's not unexpected, I guess due to the speed of maybe his USB drive. As far as he can tell, everything works exactly as it would if the OS were running from an internal drive. Actually, the one question I would have is... does it, you know, if we're not treating the USB subsystem as input devices anymore, does it recognize an external USB keyboard? But my guess is it would once it fully came up. It must just be during the boot process that it switches that around.
And the speculation I would have, you know, I was doing a little, not very deep USB work, but I was reviewing some books for another reason.
Yeah.
And there are different modes. There's like a block transfer mode where USB really opens up to do big transfers. And then there's and this is more the packet size. And I wonder if it maybe has something to do with what drivers are switched into Windows at what time, and that at some point they're really not meant to deal with anything except an input device. So that, you know, fiddle with the bus or something like that.
Just
a little speculation. I could be totally off base, but maybe there's something to it. Because from what I've seen, at least in one aspect, USB does differentiate between whether it's a bulk transfer device or a user interface device that doesn't send a heck of a lot of data.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's a good true. Hack. Did you look in... so it does involve fiddling with some really low-level stuff.
Yeah, apparently you gotta burn a new Windows installation CD or something. So no, I didn't bother doing it here, but thought it was interesting that it's there. And of course, presumably, Longhorn or Vista.
Yeah,
whatever we're going to call it.
How long is that delayed now? I heard another report.
Yeah, actually, that's right. I heard another one. speaking of reports, did you hear that the Beatles lost the lawsuit to Apple? Apple Corps lost to Apple Inc.
Oh.
Yeah, so everybody gets to just kind of move on. Although,
well, I think there was a lot of confusion.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, the last time I walked in a store, I wanted to buy a Beatles album, and I came out with a computer. I mean,
I know, and Paul lost money on that deal. And, you know, we got to give him all he can. You know, Paul's going to be 64 this year, that magical age that he sang about those many years ago.
Never thought he'd make it. Yeah, no, I know there was more to the suit than...
Yes.
It's just, guys, come on, grow up.
Yeah, and maybe we'll see Beatles songs on the iTunes Music Store, which would probably be a nice thing for all involved.
Everybody's happy.
Speaking of things that...
Except the lawyers.
No, they were really happy. Apple actually asked for their legal expenses to be covered, and the judge denied that. And he said, no, you know, you win, but you're paying your own legal expenses. They were asking for $2.6 million worth of legal expenses here. So don't say that the lawyers walked away unhappy. They they walked away very, very happy. Yeah. Speaking of other things that came up in the news, this other thing, actually, there was no press release about it. It was, I think it appeared probably on Version Tracker and Mac Update. I caught it on a little blog post, and I think we're going to have something quick about it at TMO tomorrow. TiVo released a universal binary version of their TiVo desktop. It works with Tiger. It works exactly as you would expect it to. There's still no TiVo to go. However, an enterprising little, and I don't know why the guy was digging in TiVo's plist files, but anyway, he was, found yet another option. Normally in TiVo desktop, and TiVo desktop, for those of you that don't have TiVo or don't have a Series 2 TiVo, allows you to stream your music and photos from your Mac to your TV or entertainment center or whatever you've got, which it can be really handy, depending on how you got your house set up. And we use it for music all the time, so it's nice to have that functionality back. Eventually, and by eventually, I mean within the next 2 months, TiVo has said that they're going to have the TiVo to go functionality in this, meaning you can actually take shows from your TiVo, copy them back to your Mac, watch them on your Mac, and burn them to a DVD if you so choose. So, but it's not there yet. That's still coming. However, this guy dug in there and found that there was a third option in the TiVo desktop. So instead of just music and photos, there was a tab for video. And he found a way to enable this, and it's really easy to do it. Ooh. It requires typing one line and changing a default. And then you can actually take any MPEG-2 video, or if you've used a piece of software like Galleon, the open source TiVo interface utility, to suck any files down from your TiVo, you can actually put them on your Mac and stream them back to your TiVo. So any MPEG-2 and then any .TiVo files, it will play back to your TiVo. So you know, they are expanding this thing. And of course, you know, if you enable this other feature, obviously TiVo's not going to support it. Worth a shot and worth a mention, especially if you're running an Intel Mac. And it runs fast. It's way faster than the previous one. It's using much less of my processor on the MacBook Pro to do things. So
here's something new. Something else new?
What's that?
So, you know, it was actually about a week ago where, you know, I was up and was watching 24.
Yeah.
And
which we're
going to
do in a couple of minutes here. Yeah.
Yeah, and there was a new commercial, watching it on my TiVo. Mm. And there was a new Apple commercial.
They've got a slew of them. Yeah.
You know, it's really great the first time you see it.
Yep.
And, you know, it's really great the first time you go to the Apple page and you hear it and see it.
Yeah.
I used the set Apple as my homepage for my browser. But now I don't until they get over their kind of little fascination with having a movie on the homepage and it always loading QuickTime. I don't know. And it's just, to me, any page that immediately launches into running video is kind of annoying. Guys, you put a cookie or something there saying, you know,
been there,
cut it out.
Yeah.
So I know that, I mean, the commercials are very nice, but to blast somebody like that, because usually I go to their homepage just to see if there's any new. Every now and then they'll surprise us.
That's right. Oh, yeah. They've been known to. The rumors are all saying that they're going to surprise us tomorrow morning, so we'll see.
Really? But to force a commercial down my throat every time I go to your homepage.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my little mini rant.
There you go.
So.
I want to thank everyone again for taking the time to go over to Podcast Alley and vote for us. We're actually still in the top 10. I believe we're number 9 at the moment. But, you know, I was reading through, when you go and vote over there, if you haven't done it, it also allows you to optionally leave a comment. And there was one comment there that really kind of summed up exactly for me, and I'm going to assume that there's at least some of this that resonates with John, too, why we started doing the show and what this, you know, what this kind of meant for us. And the comment was from David F., and he said, "Remember when computing was a fun hobby? It wasn't something that the suits have tried to turn into a money printing machine. It was a toy. It was a challenge. It was a world to explore. When I listen to the Mac Geek Gab, I feel almost like those days never really left." There you go. That, to me, that's why we do this, because it's fun for us, and hopefully it's fun for those of you that that choose to join us here and listen and participate. So.
We like to have a little fun, too, because, absolutely, you know, when you get down to it, I mean, we're both sitting in a room for, you know, I mean, we've got to have fun somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. All work
and
no
play. We're
going to
do it by having dazzling banter and, some of these comments are, Yeah, they're great. Thanks, folks.
Hey, there they are. So,
The band, that's right.
The band. Yeah. Oh, you know, I did want to talk about one little utility that I found. And I was actually interviewed for, I can't remember the name of the podcast, and I didn't write it down. It's not out yet, so I'll tell you next week. But I was interviewed for another Mac podcast today, and they asked me about utilities, and I mentioned this, and I wanted to mention it on the show here. It's called KeyQ. Jeff Price told us about it. What it does, it sort of harkens back to our discussion of the command line, of the command key and command key equivalents to menu options. Sometimes you're looking for something and you don't want to have to hunt through all the menus just to find the command key equivalent. What this does is it allows you to hold down the command key for a set period of time, 1 second, 2 seconds, 5 seconds. And after that interval, it displays sort of a translucent window with every command key equivalent for all of the command keys, you know, for all the menu items that are listed. So you can look at it quick, hit the key you want, and you're out of there. Very, very handy little thing, and it actually works very well. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Macility, I don't know, whatever. It's called KeyQ. You'll see it if you look in the show notes tomorrow morning. And Michael will put it in the notes now. And we love you, Michael. I think that's it. We're out of here, right?
We are?
We're done.
No,
we're done. We're at like 44 minutes.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Make sure you go to Portable Media Expo if you're interested in anything to do with podcasting. That should be a fun little show. John and I were there last year, and it was actually a very refreshing trade show, so I'm hoping that some of that vibe will last.
Same place, right?
Same place.
Go to Ontario, Canada by mistake.
That's right. I almost booked a flight to Ontario, Canada last year.
Instead of California.
I did. Yeah. Who knew about Ontario, California? We're stuck in the Northeast here.
Yeah.
Of course, this podcast was downloaded from Cashfly Hosting. If you want to sponsor the podcast, you can talk to the folks at the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. We've got more Gmail invites, although they're not replenishing them as fast as they used to. We've still got plenty. So if you want a Gmail invite, you have an audio comment, you have something to say, something to tell us, something to tell everyone else, send it in. MacGeekGab at MacObserver.com. Skype it to MacGeekGab. And the phone number is, John?
206-666-GEEK.
Geek. There it is. Thanks for listening, folks. Thanks for staying subscribed. We really appreciate it. We appreciate everything you do. And we'll see you next week.
And don't get caught.
You stole my line.
It was in the notes. I thought you forgot.
I didn't forget.